You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hey, welcome to episode 6 of Stick to Football. Connor, we have had some amazing guests over the last 6 episodes, dude. Whether it was Mitch Trubisky or Curtis Samuel or Jake Johnson, Charlie Uke, Ryan Herr, Natalie Weiner. Amazing guests through the first 5. If you took all of their Twitter followers, and hell, if you took ours as well, and combined them together, our guest this week would have more followers because we have Adam Schefter, who is the... what is he, the Tom Brady, the Michael Jordan of NFL insiders, and he has like 6.5 million Twitter followers.
Yeah, he's the Michael Jordan. I mean, I can't wait to talk to him about not even like the typical NFL questions, but just what his life is like. Because, you know, obviously we've spent a couple NFL drafts together now where I've seen your phone just going off the hook, and I can't imagine what it's like to be him with, you know, he's definitely a two-phone guy. I'm pretty positive
about that.
Yeah. He has to be a two-phone guy, but just what his life is like. So it's going to be really cool having Schefter on today. And we're going to talk about a lot of different stuff, too, including the day to, you know, draft day 2 to 3 impact rookies. You know, we talked a lot, Matt, about the top guys and draft classes as a whole, but we haven't really dived too deep into this draft class yet.
Yeah, and it's crazy because it's almost like we started to get ahead of ourselves and talk about 2018, and it was like, wait a second. Like, we're going to get to that. We're going to get to 2018 really soon, I promise. But I did. I know we both felt like it was a good time to let's take a step back, and we'll talk about some of those day 2 to 3 impact rookies, especially as I know people are starting fantasy football drafts already. So this will be, I think, good information for those of you, whether it's a dynasty draft or whatever it might be. We're going to try to give you some under-the-radar guys that we think could be big players in their first year. And then and we're just going to see where the conversations take us this week. I thought last week it went really well with Natalie because we sat back and had fun, which is what this podcast is supposed to be about. So I'm excited for episode 6. And we're kind of getting our rhythm here, man.
Yeah, we really are. I mean, it's been a lot of fun just flying through these episodes. And, you know, now it's time. We've gotten a little off the rails lately, which is a ton of fun, talking about the Bro Rompers, talking about the Lazy River. Obviously, we're always going to have our beer conversations, and especially during draft on draft. But when you look at, you know, just back to football, or should we say stick to football, you know, I think one guy that is super interesting from day two, these day two, day three classes, Jamal Williams for the Packers. Just because, you know, I've liked him for a long time, but I feel like this is the ultimate landing spot for him too in terms of instant impact. Green Bay is a team that, you know, they really need to solidify the running back position. So what they did was they took 3 in this one draft class. And I think they're going to get also help from, you know, Aaron Jones out of UTEP. But when you look at a guy that can come in and just handle the rock right away, handle contact, he's got some, you know, miles on the legs, but I think he's ready for a lot more. It's Jamal Williams for me.
Yeah, and he was someone you really liked throughout the process. You liked him quite a bit more than I did, so I'm proud of you sticking to your guy. I'm going to do the same and stick with my guy, Quincy Wilson, with the Colts. I know that he sat out, I think, day one of OTAs with a boot on his foot. I'm not entirely sure what's going on there, but I still feel like, listen, he was my number one rated corner. I loved the kid coming out of Florida. So the Colts get him in the second round. The Colts got 2 of my top 10 players, by the way, with Quincy Wilson and Malik Hooker. It's insane what Chris Ballard did in his first year as general manager there. But I think Quincy, can come in and be a starting corner for them on the outside. They desperately need size. They need a physicality on the back end of that defense. He's going to give it to them. And I'll go right into another guy for me who I think fell, Tim Williams fell because of off-field concerns. And you had that great line in, I think, episode 2 about, you know, coaches thought he was on a Jolly Rancher diet because he lost 20 pounds over the summer. There's obviously concerns about failed drug tests that he admitted to at the combine. There are some skeletons in this kid's closet. But he was a top 10 or 15 pick in terms of talent at Alabama. And so, of course, he goes to Baltimore because this is what they do. They sit and they don't panic. And Ozzie Newsome taps into that Alabama pipeline. And you get someone like Tim Williams who, as a situational pass rusher, could give you 10 to 12 sacks this year. So he's someone who, big name, fell a little bit under the radar because everyone knew he was going to fall in the draft. But now, because of the situation that he's in, I expect that, man, if he's a defensive rookie of the year candidate, I'm not going to be surprised just because he's that talented.
Yeah, I love his situation. I think they did really well also getting Chris Wormley for that front seven. When you look at Adden Williams, he's such an interesting guy because, you know, like we talked about, it seemed a little allergic to the weight room in the offseason when they'd go home, and that's always scary for any defender or any professional athlete, of course, just work ethic questions. You know, didn't love even his body and his look at the NFL Combine, and that's, you know, the interview essentially for that. It's where you could showcase yourself for that. Didn't test too well. But when you watch him on film, it's just a guy that he's just a natural pass rusher. I guess that's the best way to put it. He just finds ways to win on the outside, inside. He plays pretty strong. I know I was just, you know, trashing his weight room work ethic, but he plays strong, and I love that pick because I think he's going to do pretty well for Baltimore. You know, my second pick here is a guy that is just going to get manufactured touches. Listen, he might not have been a top five receiver in this class. He's probably a long-term number three, but Ardarius Stewart for the Jets. Somebody has to get touches for the New York Jets, and their quarterback situation is ugly, possibly, you know, bottom two in the league. There's no doubt about that. But when you look at somebody that Devin Smith's out for the year, somebody has to come in and be the number three wide receiver for this team. Eric Decker might not even be ready for
this. I was going to say, what is Decker on this roster long term? I
think he is for this year, not long term, but I think they just – listen, you need starters at the end of the day. If you go into the season with Quincy Enunwa and Stewart as the number two, if one of those guys go down, like you can't be trotting out number five, number six type players, Jerome Peake, Chad Hansen has a little ways to go, although I do like him. So when you're looking at guys that are going to get the ball and are going to be able to make plays out of these later round picks, you know, Stewart in round three to the Jets, he's going to be an instant impact player. And you don't even have to love the player, but he's going to get the ball. And that's going to be on screens, pitches, slants. He can go up and win the ball down the field. So the biggest question is, can a quarterback on this team get the ball to anyone?
Well, yeah, we'll see. I mean, you got Josh McCown, Bryce Petty, and Christian Hackenberg. I loved that they came out today and they're like, yeah, we could still add another quarterback. We could see that happening. Like, yeah, you think?
Who?
Maybe Tony Romo decides he doesn't like playing golf and talk of football in a suit.
Yeah, and it's not going to be Colin Kaepernick, that's for sure.
So. No. And you know what? We could take a second and talk about that. I am pro Colin Kaepernick should get a job as a backup if he wants to play football. Not with the New York Jets. You can't put him, I don't think, in that media environment. I've said all along, Seattle would be great for him. The Panthers would be great for him. Yeah, Tampa would have been a good spot. Like, somewhere under the radar, not the New York media market. So I hope Colin gets a job. It's no secret that I grew up a 49ers fan. I rooted hard for Colin when he took over for Alex Smith. Loved his potential. I've been frustrated with the progress or lack of progress there. I've been a critic of his on the field, but hopefully he does get a chance. If he wants to play again, I just don't see any way it's with the New York Jets or even a team that you're going to get a ton of attention, you know, whether it's the Jets or Giants or one of the LA teams. He needs to go small market, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. And I think at the end of the day, too, if you put him in Jets camp, he would have a chance to win the job. And I don't think that's a job they want to give to anyone but McCown until they're ready to see what Hackenberg has. It seems like the Jets have a plan. And I know it's crazy to say that because, like, well, they have the worst quarterback situation in the league. Well, that's fine because if you bottom out this year, you could take one of the top three guys next year. So they do have some kind of plan going on there.
They do. And I'm going to go back to a team, awesome segue opportunity here, who definitely had a plan. Another Colts player, and I actually didn't realize I did this until I just now looked at the list, but another day two to three impact guy is Marlon Mack, the running back from South Florida, who was drafted by the Colts late. Frank Gore is obviously the dude there, somehow still playing, still great. I think Marlon Mack has a chance to take some touches from him because he is a very good receiver out of the backfield. He has some speed. He has some quickness on the outside. So I look at Marlon Mack as, you know, maybe like a late sleeper at the running back position, but someone who could be an impact player this year, especially if we finally see the slowdown of Frank Gore, which I thought it was going to happen 4 years ago. It still hasn't happened. So it's great to see Frank is still, you know, churning out quality carries and getting big yards. But Marlon Mack is someone I think that you have to watch in Indianapolis as a running back of the future and someone who could definitely help in, you know, probably third down situations or sub situations right now.
Yeah, they're so interesting because they had a lot of holes, and it seems like they got a lot of instant impact players to help those holes. When you look at getting the two guys for the secondary, Malik Hooker and Quincy Wilson, and then obviously running back for the future need to be solved. And Mack's a guy that you could put in a committee, and you know, maybe he takes on more of a third down role at the next level, but either way, he could be a committee back and be a really effective one. You know, another guy that I don't know if he'll be – I do think he'll be an instant impact on special teams right away because he was one of the greatest punt returners in all of college football history is Ryan Switzer for the Cowboys. The thing is with his instant impact for me is, you know, is he going to see those snaps? He's probably kind of stuck behind Cole Beasley right now. Dez Bryant gets a lot of targets there. Understandably, they love to form that ground game with Ezekiel Elliott. So now if somebody gets hurt, Switzer can come in and help you right away on offense because he's a guy that can eat up so many possession targets and just eat out of the slot. But my instant impact for him is on special teams just because he was so good. And it's kind of weird how it's really not even talked about how effective
that's what I was going to say
was in college.
You know, on our coverage of him, we spent so much time talking about him as a deep threat and a playmaker with, you know, 20 plus chunk plays. He was one of the best punt returners in college football history. And I remember talking to his coaches there, and they were like, you have to pull up the numbers that he had brought back on penalties and things because he yes. was such a prolific punt returner. And so bringing that ability, I think, to Dallas, you're absolutely right. Like, when you look at his numbers at the end of the year, we're probably going to be like, dang, like, yeah, that dude really made some things happen. I mean, he had 5 punts returned for a touchdown as a freshman in North Carolina.
And when you do that, teams just don't kick to you.
Exactly, and that's what happened.
It happened to Will Likely on Maryland, too. Teams yeah. were like, you know what? We're not kicking to this guy. And that's what eventually happened to Switzer.
Yeah, I mean, he had 2 as a junior, 5 as a freshman. That's unreal to do that. And that's a great pick because he is going to have an impact. And obviously, he's a favorite of ours just as a player, you know, hashtag white boy supreme. But we love Ryan Switzer, so good pick there. I'm going to go to the other side of this with Caleb Brantley for the Cleveland Browns, a player
Ooh,
who
man.
I thought was probably a top 40 to 50 pick on talent, but fell in the draft because there was an allegation that he assaulted a woman in the month before the draft. Those charges were dropped. The case was basically thrown out on lack of evidence. So now the Browns have a top 40 to 50 player as a pass rusher who has a high ceiling. Now, the problem with Brantley on the field was I thought he looked out of shape at times. I thought his effort was really poor at times. The Florida Pro Day was a great example of him just not looking like he had it together. But there are moments, and especially if you go back to 2015, where he looks like a day one prospect as a defensive lineman. So we don't credit the Browns very often as football writers and analysts, and we probably never have on this podcast. But this would be a first, Browns fans. We're giving you a lot of credit because they took a gamble on the fact that Brantley was going to be, you know, able to play, that the charges were going to be dropped, and that, you know, all that was going to be kind of nullified. And now you do have a very, very high potential defensive lineman and also at a position of need for them in Greg Williams' defense.
Yeah, and this is one of those things, too, where if a team does their homework on the case and they know it's going to be dropped, it ends up looking like a great pick. And, you know, hopefully I don't have really faith that the Browns did after that post draft, you know, presser comment by Sashi Brown saying this is a player that might not end up being on our roster. But at the end of the day, you nailed it, Matt. It's a top 40 talent. The biggest thing is his motor. So if you can get the green light to go on, and we literally, I'm pulling up our draft 400 scouting report because I remember me and you basically writing the same thing when we were putting these all together. The last line, a lack of consistent motor is an issue. Everything above that is off-field stuff. So this is a guy, if you get the green light on, you have a starting defensive tackle. It's simple as that, and probably a top three one in this class. So he could be a really good player for them. It's just he has to keep it all together, and obviously there's maturity issues. A complete opposite player where, listen, I don't think the ceiling is incredibly high, but super mature, tons of starting experience. I really love his ability as a run blocker, is Dorian Johnson. You know, the Cardinals got this guy in, I believe, in the fourth round. I know they got him on day three. I think he's kind of a plug-and-play guard. He's been starting for 4 years at Pittsburgh, and he's going to be in the mix to win one of those starting guard competition, you know, the starting guard competition in Arizona. I think they could use a little help on the interior there, and he's a guy that could, he can do that right away. So it's kind of weird. He's one of those guys no one's really talking about, but when you get a guy that could be an instant starter and maybe an 8 to 10 year starter on day three of the draft, that's incredible. And so it's really well done for them.
I liked him a lot just because of the versatility as well. I think he, you know, he could play right tackle, he could play either guard spot. So getting someone like that in a pretty weak guard class to get him where they did, and you mentioned it, you know, they, you know, they missed on Jonathan Cooper. You know, they have needs on the interior of the offensive line. Obviously, you know, Mike Iupati's great at left guard, but it's him and Cole Toner battling it out for that right guard spot. And I liked Toner when he came out in the 16 draft coming out of Harvard. I actually thought he might be a better center than guard. So that would be something to watch to see if maybe Toner could slide in where A.Q. Shipley is and Dorian Johnson locks down that right guard spot. And that whole offensive line is in flux right now. You know, Jared Veld here might be going to right tackle. DJ Humphreys might be sliding to left tackle. So
there's a lot of moving parts.
Yeah, especially, you know, for a team that had a little bit of a window there where they looked really good, fell off pretty hard last year, and now you've got, it feels like they're keeping everyone together for like one more run with Carson Palmer, with Larry Fitzgerald, just trying to almost piece something together to get them over the top. So that's going to be an interesting offense to watch. You know, we love the defense because they have Hassan Reddick and Buda Baker now to go along with some other pretty amazing players, and Patrick Peterson and Tyrann Mathieu, and yeah, the potential of guys like Robert Kimdiche. So that's a really fun team to watch. And I think Dorian Johnson has a great shot here in OTAs and in the preseason to lock down something long-term for them.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if Bruce Arians wants to ride out the next wave when they move on from, you know, Carson Palmer and look to add a young quarterback. And, you know, we were talking about Mahomes to them, or a young quarterback with a lot of potential. Obviously, they couldn't get that done offseason. There's going to be guys to draft next year. It'll be interesting to see if Arians at, you know, 64 are going to be 65, kind of want to goes into that next era. But we're going to take a break. We're going to have Adam Schefter on after this. It's going to be awesome to have him on, so we'll be right back.
And welcome back to Stick to Football, Episode 6. And we are now joined by what we called him earlier, the Michael Jordan of NFL insiders. Maybe it's the LeBron James. Maybe it matters when you were born. But we've got Adam Schefter from ESPN with us. Everyone knows who Adam is because he has almost 6.5 million Twitter followers. And I got to ask you, first off, do you even read your mentions when you have that many Twitter followers? Or is it you just can't keep up with what people are talking about in your mentions?
Well, I'll be honest with you guys, and I appreciate having me, Matt and Connor. You know, I used to read some of the mentions, and I don't know how this happened. I don't know when this happened, but I don't mind that it happened. But what happened is somewhere along the way, the mentions got blocked out. And obviously, if I tweet something right now, I'll see the people's comments below. You know, my wife left me. I got it. You know, my wife left me is a very common tweet, and people seem to be in a rush to post that their wife left them as soon as I tweet anything. So I see those comments. But in terms of mentions, no, the only ones that show up are people who are verified or that I'm following, and that's it. So it used to be, again, that I would see a lot of the mentions, and every now and then you'd read the mentions, and, you know, there was some good, and there was a lot of bad Twitter stuff. Yeah, I mean, we all know how that works. And it just doesn't show up anymore. And I don't mind that because, frankly, I just try to blot out everything and just try to do my job. And if someone likes it, that's great. And if they don't like it and they're going to rip me, that's fine too. Like, but I don't see it. So that's really the deal.
Now, Adam, we live
maybe you guys know what happened there. Like, I really have no idea how that happened, but it did.
I would say it's a blessing in disguise for Adam.
Yeah.
Definitely is. Now, we live in such a mock draft crazed world where people will read them all year round. Now, we know, you know, obviously you don't write them, but if you did do one, because we know you're as plugged in literally as anyone, how good would it be? How many picks do you think you would nail?
You know, I don't know. I think there are certain years that you would be more on than others, and there are other years not as good as others. You know, this was one of those years where, you know, very few people saw the Bears trading up for Trubisky, and that kind of threw everything off right there. So that's why I always think that mock drafts are the easiest way to make, you know, somebody look silly, because one move like that throws everything out of whack, and then people remember all 32 selections. Oh, this guy got only two picks right. You know, he got Myles Garrett to number one, and that's it. And I actually thought for a little while that Trubisky may go number one, and that didn't wind up happening. But I think mock drafts are a very difficult exercise. I have respect for the people who do them, and they're kind of fun. They're kind of fun to read, you know, even though they're so infrequently correct. And mock drafts are meaningful as draft grades. You know, at this time last year, people were saying Dallas D. You know, they reached. They didn't get Paxton Lynch. They didn't get Connor Cook, but they had a reach in the fourth round, you know, with the 135th overall selection on Dak Prescott. Well, you know, that worked out okay on these draft grades. And so you never know on draft grades, just like everyone panned the Seattle draft where they took Bruce Irvin in the first round. They reached for Bruce Irvin and then, you know, just wound up getting Russell Wilson in the third round. You know, these things happen. So draft grades are silly and mock drafts are silly, but they are entertaining and they're fun to read. And again, there's a lot of people who put a lot of time into them, just think that some of that time sometimes is a little misguided. That's all.
I was going to say, I think I got 7 of 32 and felt really, really good.
That's very good.
That. Yeah. And speaking of that,
you should feel very good about that.
That Seattle draft, I gave them a D. So, yeah, it's funny because
there you go.
At the time, it looked silly. Speaking of silly, let's stay on that topic. LaVar Ball, we can't get away from it right now, but yeah. Do you see, and I tweeted about this the other day, could you ever see a situation like that in the NFL? And I know, you know, some people have said John Elway's, you know, situation or Eli Manning's situation, but how would something like that play out in the NFL if that ever happened, where there was someone who was so outspoken and so involved in the process and, you know, dictating shoe deals and saying my son's only going to work out for one team. And I know you cover the NBA a little bit now. So could you ever see that kind of coming over to our side of things?
Well, listen, I think LaVar Ball is a unique personality, and I think it's terribly unfair and remarkably off to compare Jack Elway, the late great Jack Elway, and Archie Manning to LaVar Ball. Like, Jack Elway was a great football mind, who was a football coach, who knew what worked and what didn't work. You know, he was a head coach at Stanford. He went on to become a personnel man for the Denver Broncos. And it was just really, really good. So he knew what he was doing. Archie Manning, I think we all know the respect with which he carries himself and how he handles himself. It's great. And both those guys are gentlemen. That's not to say that LaVar Ball isn't. I don't know him. But there's no part of Archie Manning nor Jack Elway that was as brash as LaVar Ball. Just not the case. You know, and could that happen? When you brought that up, the first guy that I thought of, and it's just a different kind of deal, is Todd Marinovich's dad.
Oh, yeah.
You know, who pushed his son. But again, every parental example, fatherly example, is different. You know, there's nobody like another person. And very rarely in football do you see a father that involved with somebody. And it's a situation where LaVar Ball, I think at this point probably, you know, I haven't followed that as closely, but he's probably detracting some from his son, right? I don't think he's helping the Lakers take him at number two. You know, if anything, maybe he's opened their eyes to looking at other options to see whether or not they're worthwhile. Ultimately, in the end, you know, talent prevails and you pick the player that's going to be best for your team. But, I mean, are there people in the NBA that certainly seem to be aware of, alarmed by, cautious of LeVar Ball? I think that's fair to say, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that's Marinovich is a great example. I mean, he was you know, before my time, but everything I've read about his upbringing and the way, you know, he was pushed, and that definitely seems to be pretty, you know, close. Like you said, no one is as brash as LeVar Ball, and I think our media and social media age is kind of designed to give someone like that a really big platform. So that's a great example.
Thank you.
You know, obviously the NFL has become such a, and it always will be such a quarterback hungry league, and New England, who is sitting there with two right now, and Tom Brady just seems like, he, you know, time can't beat him. He'll just play forever and be great forever. If Brady comes out again this year and just has such another fantastic season, is there any way Jimmy Garoppolo enters free agency or is even on the market next year after so many expected him to be this year and he wasn't?
You know, this is interesting on a lot of levels because there was so much Garoppolo conversation during the offseason, and I don't think that the Patriots ever considered trading him. And I know that, you know, when the reports came out that they weren't dealing him, there were people who were instantly skeptical. Oh, this is just trying to raise the price for the Patriots. Nobody's offered what they. No, they were never trading Jimmy Garoppolo. Period. That was the case in February, and in March, and in April, and it didn't stop teams from calling to inquire. But there wasn't a team out there who was going to be able to put together an offer that would have changed the Patriots' thinking into trading Jimmy Garoppolo. Now, again, going forward, how is that going to operate and how is it going to work? And, you know, are the Patriots going to risk losing Jimmy Garoppolo? My own sense is no, that they're going to figure out a way one way or another to keep him there, whether that means signing to extension or franchising him or, you know, making it work. We'll see how that plays out. But I don't think they're going to lose him. I don't think they want to lose him. I think they recognize how good they think he is. Many of us don't know that right now because we haven't seen him play on a consistent basis, but they have. They've watched him practice. They've seen him practice. They know what he is and isn't capable of, and they're big believers in him. Again, you know, I like to say this, that Tom Brady, that Super Bowl was 28-3 at one point. And if that game had continued on that course, the offseason would have been dedicated to people talking about, is it time to replace Tom Brady with Jimmy Garoppolo? So when Tom Brady turned that game around, not only did he win a Super Bowl for the Patriots, but he staved off all these questions that would have come, I believe, if they had lost that game as decisively and as one-sidedly as it was at one point in time. Yeah. So he's 40 years old this year. He's going to be 40 years old, and he's the greatest quarterback of all time. And none of that is in dispute. And he may play for 5-6 more years. He may do that. But the chances are he's not going to, because nobody's ever done that before. And again, I'm not trying to challenge the great Tom Brady in any way. Like, I would never underestimate that guy ever. But just saying, Father Time usually wins that battle, usually. Now, if he could beat Father Time, then he's even more incredible than we already think he is. So we'll see. But again, I think the Patriots recognize that they have what they believe is a commodity and a successor in the wings, and they've developed him. They've put a lot of time into him. They don't want to lose him. And I don't know how they work it out, but somehow something tells me they will figure out a way to get it done. I don't know how that is.
And I was going to say, you were the first person I saw come out and say, hey, they're not trading him. The Patriots plan to keep him, and we're going to see what happens. So that's another one that you were able to hit on. So I want to ask you one more question, and we'll let you go. And we really appreciate your time. I know how busy you are.
No problem.
I know for both of us, you know, we work hard all through draft season and football season, and then we try to unplug a little bit. We take a little vacation. When do you get to do that? Do you ever, because there is no off season. I know we all say that and it's become cliche, but there is no off season. You know, there was breaking news today and it's a random, you know, Tuesday in May. Do you ever get to take a week off and just, you know, take the family to Disney World or something and get away?
Well, you know, the nature of the job is such that there are slower times of the year. And this is one, you know, it's a nicer pace. It's not as crazy, although today when we're taping this on Tuesday, May 23rd, there was a flurry of all kinds of news and a lot of things happening. But, I mean, you know, really from May 1 to July 10, 15, it's slower. It's a more manageable pace than the rest of the year. But, you know, look, the fact of the matter is, anyone working in any field has busy times and slower times, and you know we get to do this in football, and it's great, and we're blessed to be covering the sport that so many people love and care about, and I'm included in that group. And so, you know, yeah, it's busier from say July 15 through May 1, May 5, or whatever it may be. I mean, okay, well, so what? Big deal. And that's a privilege and an honor to me, and. You know, that's not to say I don't enjoy this slower time where it's not as constant, but you know, it's nice to mix it up every now and then too.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, hopefully you do get to enjoy the slow time, because it's not that slow, and we know that you stay really busy with everything that you've got going on at ESPN. So thank you for giving us some time. And I'll just say it, you have always been super helpful, and all the way back from, I think the first time I met you is at a Peter King tweet up, and you've been nothing but kind to me ever since. So I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Matt. Thank you, Connor. I appreciate you guys having me. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks,
Adam. Thanks so much, man. Have a good one. Welcome back to episode 6 of the Stick to Football podcast. A big thank you to the always very busy Adam Schefter. It was awesome having him on and just hearing about how insane his life is, Matt, right?
It's one of those things. I think, you know, I would be lying if I said, like, man, he has the coolest job. Like, I'm so jealous of his gig. But, man, I don't know if I could do it. I like to sleep, and I like to
so hard.
Unplug and sit on my porch and drink a beer and... I don't think the people in my life would appreciate it if I was that. They would appreciate the paycheck for sure, but they wouldn't appreciate the constant connection to my phone and everything. So it's a sacrifice, man. A lot of people don't see that, but it really is, especially for someone like Adam, who's, you know, married with kids. It's a big sacrifice to give people the information that he does.
Yeah, it's incredible, really, and it's got to be exhausting at the minimum, but. You know, one thing we wanted to talk about for a while, and I think this is a really good week to do it, as we enter, I mean, it's OTAs, but essentially these are the dog days of the NFL offseason, where you're kind of just sitting around. People are looking for practice reports from OTAs, throwing drills, anything they can get. So, you know, one thing me and Matt wanted to talk about today was team building, and we've seen so many different ways that teams are approaching it and succeeding, failing. I mean, teams that are the jury's still out on. Obviously, the jury's still out on the Browns with Sashi Brown, the Jets under Mike Maccagnan. I mean, even the Titans a little bit with John Robinson, although I think they're moving on a very good pace. I think the Raiders have had an excellent rebuild under Reggie McKenzie, so we'll start with them. You know, obviously, Reggie comes from that Packers tree. He was there for a long time up until he was the director of player personnel. And it's interesting to see the mess he came into when he inherited that team, essentially a bunch of aging, overpaid veterans. His first pick of his first draft wasn't until the third round, which just
makes That's right, because it, the Carson Palmer trade, yeah.
So he was completely – and a lot of people forget that – completely handicapped when he came in and ran that 2012 draft. So the rebuild for them didn't really start in 2013. And it's so interesting with the Raiders, similar to the Jets situation right now, is that they – inherited nothing really of substantial value, and they sat back and looked at it and said, listen, we don't have to go get a quarterback right now. We, you know, the time will come for that. We need to add starting talent. And when you look at the turnaround now over the years of how they've done it, for instance, Khalil Mack, obviously a superstar, but they have so many guys besides him, Gabe Jackson, Justin Ellis, Derek Carr, all from that same draft, which is unbelievable. Getting Amari Cooper the following year. Hopefully Mario Edwards can stay healthy, because he's been really good when he has been healthy. You know, you want to see Carl Joseph and Jahad Ward take the next step this year. But the Raiders, Matt, and you know so much about that Packers tree. seem to be the blueprint of what new regime should do.
They do, and it's kind of it's interesting because John Schneider up in Seattle, also coming from that Packers tree, they kind of went about this the same way. And it's like you said, we're not going to panic if we don't get a quarterback year one. We're also not going to panic if we miss. And the Raiders missed on DJ Hayden in that first draft. One thing that I will say is I think it's so hard for a general manager to nail his first draft because, you know, you're hired in January and you don't get to bring in your own scouting staff until after that first draft. So if you're Reggie McKenzie, you're hired in Oakland, you're still dealing with the previous regime scouts, and it's you're handicapped a little bit. So your first draft is never going to be your best one unless you get lucky. But you look at, like you said, that second draft, 2014, you get Khalil Mack, you get Derek Carr, Gabe Jackson, Justin Ellis. You know, you're getting starting caliber guys. And then to follow it up in 2015, you can see the plan. And I think that's what you get from anyone from that Packers tree, is you really see the plan. And so, you know, that Packers tree is people like Reggie McKenzie, it's John Schneider, it's John Dorsey in Kansas City. And then you have people like Chris Ballard, who was under John Dorsey's now in Indianapolis. You have guys like Brett Veach, who is, I think, the VP of personnel or something out of Kansas City, who was interviewed for the Bills job. So that tree, I would say, it's, you know, it's like hardcore scouting, but they're not afraid to miss and they're not afraid to take chances. And I think that's what made Oakland great. Was it's easy to say now that Derek Carr was, you know, is going to be a great quarterback, but he was the 36th pick in that draft and a lot of people were down on him, but the Raiders drafted him and allowed him to take that starting job at quarterback. And now we're talking about them as maybe a top five team in the NFL if they can stay healthy. So it's very similar to Seattle in that way, that once they got Russell Wilson, the puzzle came together, and then you can start to kind of fill in pieces around a guy like that. And we'll see if Seattle can maintain it, because then you get to the point where you're paying 6 to 7 superstars, and it's hard to do that. But I look at the Raiders and probably the Cowboys as great examples of how to build a team through the draft and not panicking and overspending a free agency. Even though the Raiders, you know, spent on like Kelechi Osemele to build up that offensive line, this is a team that was really built through the draft.
Without a doubt, because once you build through the draft and nail all those picks, and you know, you said teams miss their first draft, they don't have their own scouting departments. It goes back to the Jets taking Leonard Williams, and this their regime taking Leonard Williams the first pick. Everyone was like, well, they don't need D-line. Well, they got a, you know, bona fide guaranteed high level starter, probably a star at the end of the day. So it's as simple as that. You don't want to miss. And when you look going back to these teams, they just added talent, because then once your cap, you know, you get rid of all these veterans and you have cap space, you're just plugging in starting holes in free agency. That's what free agency is for. And eventually when you get that quarterback as the centerpiece and he has everything around him, it all kind of clicks. Now, it's interesting to talk about a team that's doing it completely differently, I would argue, is the Cleveland Browns. Because, you know, you just rang off a list of guys that are coming from, you know, top-notch mentors and franchises. And then you go Sashi Brown and you say, well, you know, obviously highly educated, but football background-wise, you know, who has he learned under? What has he done? And when you look at their strategy, obviously super heavy into analytics, and I think their first draft, taking Corey Coleman, you know, with the 15th overall pick in 2016, kind of signals that, because he's an analytics guy, highly productive at Baylor, you know, great testing at the combine, you know, he's got speed, he's got it all, but, you know, is he smart? Can he learn a playbook? Is he reliable? Can he stay healthy with that frame? All those things. So it's so interesting to see how the Browns do it, because at the end of the day, the biggest thing with analytics is that I think they ignore the human element of it. And old school scouts, that's such a big majority of what they do.
Yeah, and I think you have to have a balance, right, between...
Yes. Analytics are helpful. There's no doubt.
Exactly. And, you know, I fall on the side very often of, I need to be able to see it on film. Like, I don't care if you can do the advanced math that tells me that Myles Garrett is a great prospect. I need to see it. Like, I have to see it with my own eyes. And there are going to be times where someone like Myles Garrett hits for analytics and he hits for old school scouts. But, you know, in my perfect world, there's a balance between You know, I might want to use analytics to tell me about the value of the three cone drill, you know, for defensive backs or receivers. Or I might want to use it for, you know, what is the actual value of a right tackle in the NFL today? How much should we be paying that position? But what I worry about, like with Corey Coleman, is a great example. I was not a huge fan of his. I mean, I liked him. You know, he's tough, he's physical as a route runner, but he was so limited at Baylor. He ran three routes. And my concern with small wide receivers is that as a quarterback, you better be really, really accurate because that catch radius is so small. And the NFL is, of course, all about separation. Corey Coleman can arguably separate with speed, but he still has that tiny little catch radius. So when you don't have a quarterback like a Derek Carr or Russell Wilson who can really thread that needle to him, and I think that's one of the most underrated things about Tom Brady ever, is that when you look at all his receivers now, they're all small guys, and he's still able to remain highly accurate. I think it's harder with someone like Coleman, and that is one reason I liked the David Njoku pick for them, is because now they have a big target. You know, letting Terrell Pryor go, but bringing in Kenny Britt, you still have a big target for whomever's going to play quarterback, whether it's DeShone Kizer or Cody Kessler. But I do look at the Browns, and everyone that I know in the NFL looks at the Browns as kind of this, like, it's almost like a test tube thing where everyone in the NFL is waiting to see if this is going to work. And they've had 24 draft picks in the last 2 years. Like, that's half a roster right there in a draft. So everyone is waiting to see, hey, will this work? But I've been told by people, and I think you were actually with me with one of these conversations where we were talking to an executive, and he was basically like, you know, it sucks that this thing is happening. The analytics test is happening at Cleveland because they're not going to get, you know, you have to completely rebuild a roster from the ground up with very few building blocks. So it is going to be, I think, interesting, and it's kind of exciting because the NFL has largely been unchanged in all the time I've been covering it. So you have someone come in that is a little bit different than the Green Bays and the Seattles and, you know, Kansas City and Indianapolis and places like that. But I see on your notes here, you have the Jets because that's your team, obviously. But, you know, I knew Mike Maccagnan a little bit because I had actually applied for a job with the Texans before I started at Bleacher Report. So I knew who he was. He wouldn't know who I was if I walked up to him and said hello. But that is an interesting team because it feels like they have changed philosophies a little bit. And you can look at their, you know, first draft. I loved getting Leonard Williams, but they've missed in the second round, you know, with Devin Smith. Christian Hackenberg, man, we're all still waiting to see. And I don't think anyone can intelligently say if he's the guy or not, but
it was a reach.
Find out. It was a reach. No matter.
It's as simple as that. Yeah. You know, if he turns into a star or average starting quarterback or whatever he ends up being, it would just been really surprising if a team took him in the second round.
I agree. And it's funny because if they had drafted Darren Lee at 20, Jordan Jenkins at 51, and Christian Hackenberg at 83,
completely
like,
different.
That's a pretty good draft. But you take him in the second round and it's like, oh shit. Like, yep. There's pressure now, boys. Like he better become something or somebody's getting thrown under the bus. And I feel like this year, I don't know if this is the case or not. I don't know if they even think about things like this, but I felt like the Jets' first four picks were all really, really solid, no nonsense, like very high floored football players. Like, yes. Jamal Adams might not become Eric Berry, but he's going to be really good. And Marcus May might not be Landon Collins, but he's really good. And Ardarius Stewart, super solid. Chad Hansen, very, very solid. So it's one of those drafts where it felt like they recalibrated a little bit and said, okay, like, let's just go get some really good football players who we know are going to be high character, great leaders, and we're not going to have to worry about them on or off the field.
100%. And they're just a team that inherited such a bad roster, and they're still trying to figure out a way to turn that roster around after, listen, the instant rebuild was kind of a Band-Aid. Yeah, they won 10 games, just missed the playoffs. You know, it was a lot of vets, and they wisely structured those contracts to be two-year deals, where the beginning of next offseason, cap-wise, they essentially get a chance to start over again. But now they have some of their guys that they've drafted over the years that are going to be solid starters. And, you know, obviously the quarterback situation is such a big factor. And if they do bottom out this year, they'll have a chance to pick one in the top five next year. But, you know, looking at a team that did benefit from the same thing, bottoming out and picking a quarterback in the top five, the Tennessee Titans, John Robinson, who comes from, you know, big scouting background with the Patriots, obviously was an executive for the Bucks. The Titans, you know, and it's funny, Robinson actually wasn't even the GM when they picked Mariota. He came in right after that.
That's right.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, he's done a pretty good job building out the 53-man roster there in a way, in, I guess, kind of a Raiders way, where, you know, a lot of BPA for them or just safer picks. I think, you know, Corey Davis this year is such an interesting pick because, once again, I was the first one to say this is a giant reach, but the ceiling just seems so high for him, and it would fill the need, and he's good character, and he's not raw. Most receivers coming out of college are very raw. He was coached so well, and he has a complete route tree. So when you look at how the Titans are doing it, they just seem like a team that has really flipped the switch, similar to the Raiders.
And they've done a great job with moving up, back. You know, they traded out of the spot and allowed they allowed Cleveland to come up, or no, I'm sorry, they allowed the Rams to come up. And,
yep.
And
oh, what a haul. Draft capital, guys.
And, you know, it's funny because I'm sure you could look it up, and I'm sure I wasn't a fan of their individual picks in the 2016 draft because I thought Jack Conklin at 8 was a reach. But you play him at right tackle, and he's a different player. And he was really, really good at right tackle. Kevin Dodd, solid. Austin Johnson, I know teams that had a first-round grade on him. And it's funny because when you start talking about the Titans, it's like, man, the only pick I didn't really like was Derrick Henry. He was their fourth pick. I like it a hell of a lot better when you look back a year later and you're like, damn, he was their fourth pick in that draft. That was a really good class. And, you know, Tajae Sharpe was a player last year, and you got him in the fifth round. So I think John Robinson, and, you know, kind of extending this conversation, like the Patriots tree is a hard one because you're not getting Bill Belichick and you're not getting Tom Brady. And those are the two things that make New England, New England. And that was, you know, something I've really defended a lot on Twitter lately is people who think that, you know, like Rex Hogan gets hired by the Colts. People are like, oh, the Jets suck. Why are we hiring this guy? Well, like the Jets haven't, they weren't very good last year. And you might not agree with all their draft picks, but that doesn't mean that Rex Hogan's a bad scout. And, you know, it doesn't mean that Ed Dodd's coming from Seattle's a great scout because they've been good. Like, good teams produce bad scouts, and bad teams produce good scouts. So it's, you know, talking about evaluators, it's almost like talking about players. You can't give them too much credit for what's around them, and you also can't give them too much blame for what's around them. So I look at John Robinson and even Bob Quinn up in Detroit as, you know, two guys who left New England with great scouting backgrounds, and they really did their time there and earned their stripes. And I think that's why they have chances to succeed where others did not. It also helps that they both, like you said, walked into situations where they had quarterbacks. Quinn had Stafford, and he has played much better, you know, with Jim Bob Cooter as his offensive coordinator. So you got to give them credit there. But also, you know, Marcus Mariota, like you said, he walked right into that situation. And to his credit, has made the team around Marcus better, and they've invested a lot of resources and early draft picks in trying to give him protection and trying to give him targets, whether it's Corey Davis and Taylor and Jonnu Smith, or, you know, last year protecting him with Conklin, giving him Derrick Henry and Tajae Sharpe. So that's an exciting team. I think I saw today Peter King ranked them in the top five for next year. Like,
wow.
I thought I was a Nashville fan, right? Like,
that's,
man,
a big jump.
Yeah.
But they brought in a guy in Robinson that's been a good – listen, so much of these guys that are hardcore scouts, the biggest adjustment for them when they take GM jobs is decision-making. And when you look at Robinson, the way he's been able to flip picks, I mean, that's just great decision-making at the end of the day when you could get that much draft capital back. And the biggest thing for guys like McKenzie and Robinson, and, you know, McCagnan's actually been really good at building depth. The biggest thing is obviously landing a franchise quarterback, but getting, you know, high-level starters. Because rounding out the 53, a lot of these hardcore scouts are having success doing it, but that'll only keep you there for so long. So, I mean, it's fascinating the way teams are building, the team building process in the NFL. There's so many different ways to do it. But, you know, we'll get into the draft on draft segment for this week because you guys sent us so many good questions. We have a ton of questions. So we got to start with one that I almost don't want to answer it because Matt has a video coming out on this tomorrow, but we'll do it anyway because it won't completely give away the video. This one's from Drew, who sent us a ton of good questions over the weeks. Who's your favorite quarterback out of these three? Josh Allen, Sam Darnold, or Josh Rosen, and why?
Oh, man. Well, you know, mine is Josh Allen, and I'll be short and sweet with it. It is because I feel like he has the highest upside. I've said this for a while now. I think he had more upside than any quarterback in this class. He has excellent arm strength. He has athleticism. He plays under center in a pro-style offense, and he does make a lot of mistakes. The Nebraska game is great evidence of that, but I like the upside there the most. I'm intrigued by Darnold. He's only played 8 games. I do worry about the release point being kind of long, a little stiff, but I like his leadership. I like his toughness. And with Josh Rosen, hell, you'll see it in the, like you said, the video that we did. The kid is picture perfect. It's beautiful, but I worry about the shoulder injury. I worry about the fact that the rumor is the kid's not coachable. All those things kind of add up to make you worry about Josh Rosen. And I actually heard a couple days ago, it's not a lock, people talking to him, that he's going to come out. There's a chance that he might stay for another year.
Yeah, and it's interesting that he might do that, because listen, he almost missed a year last year. You know, after what, 5 starts, he was out for the year, serious shoulder injury. For me, it's Rosen, but it's kind of the same argument for you as Josh Allen, where I just think he has the most upside. He's the most natural thrower of the three to me. And when you look at, listen, I don't think he's the same kind of athlete that Josh Allen is. He definitely doesn't have the same kind of intangibles as a leader that, you know, that Darnold does, but just such a natural thrower. And I just think that, listen, this is the year where as a freshman, he had a fantastic year, but this seems to be the year where if he has help in front of him, where the offensive line can protect him, and, you know, the weapons step up a little bit, he can just make throws and plays that I don't think any other quarterback can in the college football landscape. But the biggest question for him will be, obviously proving his health, but more importantly, too, is answering those off-field questions, character questions. So it's going to be fascinating between these three, and there's just so much that has to play out. Speaking of so much that has to play out, our next question, same thing, this one from Anthony Mangaluzzo. So he's another guy that sent us so many good questions over the weeks. Who is the prospect you are most excited to watch in 2018? I'll give you one that I'm just going to throw it out there because nobody besides people from New Jersey and Notre Dame fans know that he might be a prospect yet. But for me, it's Brandon Wimbush, just because, and it would surprise me if he came out after next year, but he's got a cannon of an arm. He can run. He's one of those guys where it might be a one-year wonder, and he has to come out because he's just so talented.
Man, I've heard the Brandon Wimbush hype for 3 years now, so that's a very good one. I'm going to say Derwin James, and this is everyone. Yes. Everyone knows who Derwin James is, or will. He's a safety for Florida State. He's built like, I don't know, he's built like a man. I mean, he
plays like a middle linebacker, but moves like a corner.
Right. But he was hurt last year. He played 6 yep. quarters. So I'm a little worried because now the hype for this kid is, I have people saying like, man, this is the best safety prospect ever. People on Twitter, not people in the NFL.
Oh, gosh. Be careful.
People on Twitter, probably from Tallahassee. So I want to see the hype. I've gone back and watched him in 2015, and that defense was loaded in 2015. I wanted to see him last year. Like I said, played 6 quarters before he got hurt. So he is the guy that, man, I watched the spring game, looked pretty dang good. So I'm excited to see. And what, they play Alabama week 1, I think. Is that right? So
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, talk about a great game to come out and showcase your skills. So Derwin James, and listen, I'm a quarterback guy through and through, and then I would say receivers next, but I love watching good DBs, as everyone knows, because of my Jamal Adams man crush. So Derwin James is a dude that I'm really excited about.
Yeah, he's another field general, just like Adams was, but he might even have more raw talent. So it's going to be so interesting to see him, you know, put it all together this year, or when he's finally fully healthy after, you know, being knocked out last year, which is super disappointing. This one from Matthew Joe: why do teams give insider news when they don't want other teams to know? You know, sometimes it's because they simply want teams to know bad info, so sometimes it's just bad info. And other times, it's so they could, you know, spin it their own way, so it gets out in the right way, I would say. But Matt can speak to this one. As you know, this is a guy that's broken so much news over the last 2 years where he can give you 50 different reasons.
Well, I think what people don't realize is that it's a trade of information. And also, there's this perception that, like, you know, we'll just say I'm talking to the Browns. There's this perception that, like, in the public, that people's like, oh, the Browns don't want everyone to know who they like. there are people in the Browns organization who don't care. Like, their job is not to hide this information. And they might also be disgruntled employees. You know, there are a lot of different scenarios where information gets out that teams don't want guys like myself to know. And I mean, we just had on the king of breaking news, Adam Schefter. So we probably should have asked him this one, but it things get out. And, you know, I have been lied to. It happens. It'll happen again. It sucks. You try to learn from it. But also, you know, I think there's, you know, everyone, especially scouts, they love to talk. And because they are silenced throughout the process, you know, as soon as they get into a draft room, their opinion really isn't listened to much anymore. So they will talk to guys like me or Adam or, you know, Peter King or whoever else it might be.
A lot of people.
So it
especially
is.
Especially down at Mobile.
And yeah, we spend time with them too. So they become your friends. You know, it would be like me telling you about something that happens to me or something I see about a player. And it's more, you know, you're friends with these guys, so they talk to you about things, as opposed to, you know, it's this like Watergate thing where we're, you know, slipping each other manila envelopes and you know, it's super secretive. That'd be cool though. I would much rather it was like that.
That would be pretty sweet. I wouldn't put it past them either. This one from the Drew Print: what is your least favorite rule change of the past 5 years? I think for me, it's not a set in stone rule change, but I think it's just how each year it just becomes harder to play defensive back in the National Football League, and it absolutely kills me. The guys can't do anything, whether it's illegal contact, whether it's questionable pass interference calls, uncatchable passes not being called. It's so hard to play defensive back in the league, and I just wish the refs would be able to lighten up on it, but points sell. It's as simple as that.
Exactly.
And, you know, it sucks.
Mine is this 10-minute overtime bullshit that we're about to see. But my least favorite thing about the NFL in the last 5 years is touchdown commercial, extra point commercial, kickoff commercial. Like, that makes – I just get mad. Like, thank God for the Red Zone channel. But, you know, when you're watching Sunday Night Football, Monday Night Football, Thursday Night Football, like, that – man, they got to do something about that. And I know Roger Goodell has said it too, but that gets my blood boiling. It drives me crazy that the NFL is like, hey, let's get three more commercials in here because we're not making enough money already. It does make it unwatchable.
And from a video guy perspective too, and for you, that's someone that's on camera, it makes it so hard for the broadcast to get into flow. It's just like break, you know, 1 minute of air break. And it's like, man, like it's hard. It makes it really hard. So hopefully that changes. This one from Shane Merriman. Vancouver is Sean Merriman. Who in the AFC has the best chance of beating the reigning champ Patriots and making the Super Bowl? I'm not even going to waste your time going on a rant. It's the Raiders.
Yeah, it is. That's it. That's the only team I could think of off the top of my head. They just have – they have the pieces. They have the quarterback. They have the pass rusher. They have the running back now. They have Amari Cooper. It is the Raiders. And – I thought last year, if Derek Carr hadn't broken his leg, they had a shot to go all the way because of how well they were playing. They're well coached. They're tough. They have a chip on their shoulder. That's it, man. And
yeah,
we'll eventually do our picks, right? We're going to do some previews and we'll pick that stuff.
No doubt.
But I'm a Patriots homer, so I'm going to, it won't be a surprise when I pick the Patriots to win another Super Bowl.
Yeah, it's hard to pick against them. The only two wild cards are even in the Raiders division, and that would be the Broncos if Paxton Lynch turns into a star, which I'm just not expecting this year, and then the Chiefs if Patrick Mahomes turns into an instant impact star, because they have rosters to win, obviously, but it's just a matter of I just don't expect that, so it's the Raiders for me. This last question to wrap up the show is so good, from Greg Armstrong. I call this the Holy Grail of draft on draft questions. You have to create your own six pack with your all-time favorite beers. What do you put in it? It's such a good question. One that I know I'm putting in right off the top is a Pacifico.
I was gonna say mine would be Boulevard Wheat, and Pacifico are in there already. Wow, that's hard, man.
I think I can rattle it off.
All right, let's hear it.
It would be Pacifico, Blue Point, which is a beer from Long Island out here. See, I say I could rattle it off, and then I get stuck like two beers in. It's just so hard, man. Founders would be in there for me as a third. I'll try to alternate to lighten it up a little bit. I had when I was around Kansas City with you guys like 2 months ago. God, sorry, 2 months ago. I have to say, Boulevard is incredible. Every single one. I don't even know what one I'd put in there. I had three of them. Yeah. They were all good.
I have five. If you could hear me typing, it was because I was right. I was typing them down. Okay. So Boulevard Wheat, because that's my all-time favorite beer. Pacifico, favorite like summer beer, super drinkable. Allagash White. I'll rep the Northeast here.
Oh, Allagash White is great.
Such a good beer. Erdinger, which is a Belgium wheat beer. It's probably my favorite. Like if I'm gonna splurge and just have like two beers. Like, it's kind of hard for me to find here in Missouri, but I love it. So, hey, if anyone has one, and I'll DM you my address, you can send it to me. That would be great. And then my favorite Indianapolis beer, because I'm at the Combine for so long every year, the Sun King Cream Ale is so good. It goes with everything. It's just smooth. It's like the right mixture of hoppiness. It's a beautiful beer. So those are my five.
The two more I would add in would be, one would be Delirium. Delirium is
that's so really, New York of you.
It really is, man. But if you have like a couple too many, it could ruin the rest of your week. They're that strong. And then anything from Bronx Ale, which is another total New York move by me. Bronx Summer Pale Ale, obviously, is just delicious. But that's an excellent question. And I hope a lot of people listen. If you want to get involved, subscribe, leave us a review. And in your review, you don't even have to say anything good or bad about us. Just leave what your customized six-pack would be. That's all I'm asking you to do. So leave a review after subscribing. Put in your customized six-pack. Matt, we got a pretty big show next week, too.
We do, man. A huge show. We have Taylor Lewan. We also have my brother and our quarterback assistant guru, Marshall, is going to kick off the 2018 quarterback class with us. It's going to be a lot of fun as we roll into summer. Before we go today, though, there's one thing I want to plug, and you guys probably saw me tweeting a lot about this Monday, but there's a GoFundMe that our friend Adam Williamson from Alabama, I guess he's from Mississippi, but we met him at the Senior Bowl. He kind of brought this to my attention for a little girl named Kaya, and we're doing our best to try to get this thing going, trying to spread the word about it. So we're going to tweet out the link to this GoFundMe page. It would mean the world to Connor and I, and especially to this family, if you could. If you can't donate $5, that's awesome.
Help promote it. Yeah.
Yeah, just retweet it.
Even $1. Yeah. If everyone gave $1, you could really change someone's life. So it'd be just super cool. I mean, I care more about that than the custom six pack, and you know how much I care about the custom six pack.
Right.
So either way, it should be awesome if you guys could help us out. And Matt, next week we'll get a little Predators talk now that they're in the Stanley Cup. We had a lot to talk about today, so we didn't get to do much hockey, but with Taylor Lewan on, we're not ignoring.
Yeah, we will talk Predators, and we'll talk about throwing catfish and chugging beers, and it'll be
hand on beers.
Taylor Lewan might be the mascot for this show. If we were going to get one, it would probably be Taylor Lewan, which is he's a lot of fun, man. So it's going to be a blast next week. There'll be three of us driving the boat for the show, and then we have a kick-ass guest. So it's going to be a lot of fun for sure.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You said Josh Allen today is your guy for next year. I said Josh Rosen. Melo is a Darnold guy. So you get so many different opinions on the Stick to Football podcast, but listen, we'll be back next week. Thank you so much for your draft on draft questions. Thank you so much for joining us, guys. We can't wait to talk to you again next week.